right, how's everybody doing? Welcome to Monday. Oh my God, it's Monday, June 15th. Can you believe it? And I'm on time. It's only 6:01. Usually it's about 6:07 when I'm coming on live because, as everyone knows from watching the show, I'm a musician, so time is relative. Sometimes with music, unless I'm playing, in which case I'm always in time. So I'm Mike Jeffers, Chicago Jazz Magazine, chicagojazz.com, and welcome to Chicago Music Revealed. I'm also the director of programming at the Epiphany Center for the Arts, so I appreciate everyone tuning in again. We are on episode 52, and we have got a very fun couple of guests here because I've known them for a very long time, and I wanted to connect with them because, you know, running a business during COVID-19 is one thing, but then also running a vintage drum business just in normal times is a whole other experience, which I love. And they've just been growing leaps and bounds since we first started talking, geez, I don't know, 15 years ago, maybe. So I'm happy to have on Steve Maxwell of Steve Maxwell Vintage Drums, Custom Drums, and also Steve Jr. is on. Let's talk a little bit because, you know, you and I, Steve, you and I have known each other for a while. I remember when you first started the drum shop, you were down at the Fine Arts Building, and then it just continued to expand and expand and expand. But I also look at you as one of those business owners that saw the light with the internet because you always had an internet presence. You were able to connect people throughout the entire world. And I feel like with your business and with the, you know, vintage and custom drums business, you were able to connect with a lot of people that normal vintage drum, you know, dealers back in the day could never connect with because they weren't thinking about being online as much as you were always online, right?
Customer base was international, especially for vintage stuff. So, you know, we had to have a good presence there, and you had to have a sense of integrity. People had to be able to trust you because they can't come from 4,000 miles away to come into your shop and try out the drums. So for us, it was important to establish the trust, to establish those connections, and especially on the vintage side where that was really, really critical. So we do a lot of that, and we do a lot of it all over. So if you don't have that connectivity, you're dead in the water.
It's one of those things, you know, and the way that you do stuff online, I love because, I mean, you do a lot of the videos, and now Steven's doing a lot of the videos too, and he's jumping in and doing podcasting and starting to connect with all these different people. But, you know, from the get-go, you would sit there and you would demo these drums. I mean, you would be on your website, you'd demo these drums and talk about them and talk about the history of the specific drums, talk about where they came from, who played them. You know, like, oh, this was Max Roach's drums, and this was this, and this was that. And I mean, you know, that's that really important thing. Now, you come from a business background, but that just that little business sense, meaning you need to connect with somebody and have them trust you and you trust them in order to grow a relationship, right?
Yeah, a big part of it is, and a big part of it for me is it's nice to always sell drums. That's fine. But a lot of what we have are products that are items that belong to people who were famous. But by the same token, you also want to pass on information about those people because there's a history there of the great players of the past who influenced players of the generation beyond them and beyond them. And a lot of people today don't realize how much the influence goes back to 30, 40, 50, 60 years from today back. And right now, as a matter of fact, I do a monthly column for Modern Drummer magazine, and the title of that column is From the Past. And the point of that is to actually bring up people who were players in the past that the modern generation of people may not know about, but know about. Mm-hmm. So we think that's important. So it's passing the message of information and part of it is as well, not just selling drums.
Right, right. Well, and that's always been a big part of it because I remember the first time I came down to the shop when it was at the Fine Arts Building. I mean, you have a museum as well, like a drum museum, and some of these famous drum sets that God knows where they would be if you didn't pick them up and get them before somebody. I mean, somebody might have just thrown Sonny Payne's drums out on the street at one point. I mean, who knows, right? So, I mean, you're able to collect these things, but then you're also, I feel, giving back to the music community because of the way you're displaying them, because of the fact that you have like a museum where people can come in and see it and learn about the history of those drums. I mean, that's an important part of this whole thing.
It is. I agree. And, you know, part of that is you invest in those instruments. Some of them I don't ever look at them as being myself as being the owner of them. I look at myself as being the caretaker of them until we find the next person who's the next caretaker. A friend of mine is now the publisher of Modern Drummer, David Frangione. David is down in Florida. And some of the kits that I had are now down there, the Louis Belson kit, the Buddy Rich kit, things like that, where they'll be able to be seen by more people, and I think that makes sense. And a big part of what we've been doing here in Illinois that's been really, really helpful is as a base of operations with our own recording studio, Steve Jr. is taking care of everything from running that studio to how to do podcasts, you know, keeping me on a schedule to do the podcast because I get so busy, and all the audio, video, and all of that stuff, that all happens through him. So that one's all in his ballpark. That's I'd be lost because I don't even know how to turn the stuff on. You know?
Well, you know what though? I mean, and that.
Thanks, Dan.
Yeah, right. And that goes to that too. You know, I mean, you know, Steve Jr. Let's talk a little bit about that because you and I connect. I mean, we've known each other for a while, but with all this pandemic stuff, you connected, reached out because you have a podcast that you do in the store when you can get people to come to the store in person, which we're starting to loosen up. So. And nice enough to ask me if I'd be on your podcast. So I'm looking forward to coming out to the store and doing that in person. But I'm talking a little bit about that because, you know, I'm a big believer, especially with an online business. I mean, you know, you guys have brick and mortar stores. There's a couple of them, one in Glendale Heights here, one in New York. And then where's the other one at? Nashville? Is that the other one?
Yeah. Yeah, we bought Forks Drum Closet from Gary a couple of years ago. So Forks is down there, too. And I moved the Craviato manufacturing facility from California to Nashville last year.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So, but that virtual aspect, and then, I mean, what other businesses, especially in a drum business? I mean, I don't see Ludwig. I don't see DW. I don't see any of these drum companies specifically pushing out podcasts, specifically pushing out like regular content, and then having the owner actually discussing stuff and talking about the podcast and creating that relationship back and forth to the customers, you know. So Steve Jr., why don't you talk a little bit about the studio you set up and the concept behind the podcast and where people can check it out?
Sure. Yeah, it's a really special part about our Illinois store, and it's a really essential part. We're a little further out. We're not right in downtown. We're out in the suburbs, and so I have a little bit of extra time, and I just use that time to slowly build up a really nice room that's just perfect for recording drum sets, and I really try to record them in a way that gives a real natural sound. Not too many mics, you know, there's and try and get the room so that basically we can put these videos up on YouTube and people can listen to the kits or sometimes just sound files or the cymbals, and try and get it so that they can hear the most accurate version of that I'm capable of producing. And so, yeah, we also record bands there sometimes too. It's kind of a multi-use studio, and we've got some really cool analog tape stuff that we do as well.
You know,
that's a fun little thing that, yeah, I'm anyone listening who's gone to our there's a couple of videos where there's like walkthroughs and you can see all our tape machines. We love that. That's kind of like a hobby almost. but and then when it comes to the podcast, that's a really recent thing. And it was my dad had done one a long time ago, maybe 2 years ago, because our internet presence didn't really start with me. Mm-hmm. It did start in New York a while back. And continued it. I mean, I've been with the job for, what is it, Dad, like 5-6 years now?
It's at least six. Yeah.
Because there was a while where I didn't work at the shop, and yeah, it's been at least 6 years. And then I just kind of took the torch and moved on with it. And yeah, it's a great opportunity for me and out here in the Western, you know, burbs because we have a little more space than in like New York or even, yeah, I mean, the Nashville store, even there. Yeah, there's much less space. We've got the space to do a nice little studio setup. And then the podcast, like we were talking about, my dad had done some probably 4 years ago.
Oh, longer than that. we had started doing it 5 or 6 years ago in New York, but then, you know, I didn't continue with it, and it wasn't convenient because I had to travel to New York to do it.
Yeah, right.
So it wasn't convenient, and we kind of fell off the radar with it. It wasn't about a year and a half or so ago when we started really cranking it up again with you.
And then there were maybe like 10 or 11 episodes, and then we called it. There's, you can still get those. They're just you talking about vintage stuff. And then the new ones we've been doing, we call the ones like old episodes. And then the new episodes, they're most of them are with me and my dad talking about vintage drums, talking about the history, talking about art shop. And like the first episode was your history on how you started on drums. And then sometimes we interview local musicians, mostly drummers, but I had one of my old teachers come, and it's good fun, you know. Well, we have a good time.
Where can people hear it? Is it up on Apple? It's up on all the platforms, all the iTunes, all the podcast platforms, I should say. And of course, it's probably available at maxwelldrums.com, right?
Yeah, Dad, we should talk about our new website. But before that, the podcast we've done up until now, I actually had a bunch saved before the whole virus thing happened. So those are the ones I'm putting up now. Ah. We don't do them live, you know. But the ones that we have, you can get them just about anywhere. We use Podbean,
sure.
And so through there they go to Apple Podcasts, and then eventually I put up the videos on YouTube.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're all on the YouTube channel as well. That's the cleanest way. And then on the MaxwellDrums.com website, I do have a page that is our podcast page, and it's got little breakdowns of the videos, and you can click to all of those and go see them and enjoy them there as well. Yeah.
You know, Steve Jr., you brought up a great point too, that, you know, you set up the studio there so that you could get the most natural sound of the drums possible. I mean, I didn't even think of that, but yeah, you're right. I mean, with me playing a drum set here in my office with a couple of mics on it, you don't really get the full flavor of what that is. And if you're planning on actually trying to sell this stuff online, you really need to know, you know, what you're buying. So that's a really good point. I mean, how long did it take you to really conceive and come up with the best way to actually get a good sound out of some of these vintage sets, so people that are buying it in Italy or something can understand what it really sounds like?
Well, I would say I still haven't. It's an ongoing process, but I'm always trying to make everything better every day. And at this point, I try and get a kind of a nice combination of the sound of the room with some nice room microphones, and then a couple microphones that are a little bit closer. I usually don't use really, really close up mics. And then I use as little processing as possible. And, I mean, yeah, it's an ongoing process though. So I'm always trying. If anyone has any, I'm always looking for, you know, suggestions and you know, but advice and everything. But yeah, it's been, I mean, this studio, this particular one, we've been in this room about 4 years. But if you include the old shop, it's been about 5 years, mm-hmm. that we've been an ongoing process trying to dial it in.
and it's important to keep it down as natural as possible. So we don't want to do a lot of processing. You're selling a vintage kit. When I set that kit up, I'll generally have the kind of heads that were on it, coated ambassadors, maybe things like that, to represent the sound as purely as we possibly can. And because that's what we're selling. We're selling a vintage kit that has a certain sound to it. So maybe that's not a candidate for a Power Stroke 3 bass drum head. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
So we just try to balance it off.
Let's talk a little bit about the background of this, because, I mean, you got into this, I think it was your hobby when you were running other businesses, and then you got into this, and you started, if I remember when we were first talking, you just started accumulating stuff, and that's how you ended up down at the Fine Arts Building to just kind of get started. Did you ever think in your wildest dreams that you would have turned a vintage drum business or just a hobby into what you have now with stores in three different states and an online presence, and I'm sure you're moving drums back and forth. I mean, what's the average, like, what's like a yearly inventory, like 10, 15,000 drum sets going back and forth or drums? I mean, you're doing a lot of business, right?
I don't know. You know, when you think about it, I mean, right now, if I think about it from an inventory standpoint, I think when I looked at it last, we have somewhere in the neighborhood of 6,000 cymbals. Probably about 500 drum sets and about the same number of snare drums allocated across all of those three shops, and then miscellaneous accessories and everything else, and not counting the stuff that's in the museum part of it as well. So it's hard to imagine to go from, we were in the fine arts building and I used to go in one day a week on Sundays in our little 500 square foot space, and you know, it was kind of the big deal. I go far back that started selling online. There was no, you had to email your information to someone who 2 weeks later would update the website so that your stuff would be current, you know? So it goes back a long ways, and you can't even imagine going from that to where we are today, where everything's on the fly. During COVID, I just set up a little, impromptu studio in the living room here, and we can spread content around easily. So it's been an interesting journey. And, you know, it's like everything else has ups and downs. That's life. But it's pretty interesting. It went from 500 square feet in the Fine Arts Building to, you know, we got 7,000 square feet out in Glendale Heights, which is great because it's inexpensive space. It's beautiful. New York is not, you can't have that much space in New York. You got a couple thousand square feet there. But we got 35,000 square feet in Nashville. So
wow.
It's become an entity of its own, and it's a little wild and crazy at times.
Well,
hey, we're having fun with it.
I still love the fact that you retired and you started a hobby business that turned into like a monster, and you're traveling all over. It's like, I can remember when I was trying to track you down, you know, back in the day when you opened the New York store, and it was like you were traveling more than when you were running the other businesses. It was like, oh my God.
You're right. It got to the point where it got to the point where it just got crazy. I don't know if you can call a benefit to COVID, but sometimes we think about the pace we're running at,
yeah,
and that pace really isn't sustainable if you think about it, and this forced us to step back and look at things differently. So in some respects there's some positive that you can take out of it. It's hard to say that, but it does force you to think about simplifying things so that you can sustain the pace that you're at.
Yeah.
It wasn't sustainable before. A lot of us are in that same boat. It's like we can't sustain it, but we keep doing it because we have to. Well, now we were kind of, you know, pulled up short and say, you got to take a time out.
Yep.
So that was helpful.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because on this show, I talk to a lot of musicians from all over the country. And I believe, and it sounds like it's exactly what you're saying, is that, you know, if there's a silver lining out of this whole thing, you know, musicians are so used to running from gig to gig to gig to gig to gig, and there, you know, and this caused them to take a little bit of time to start learning technology a little bit better, to understand how to connect with maybe a wider audience because they're doing some live stream things like that. From a business standpoint, to your point, it just makes you stop and go, well, wait a minute, you know, I'm doing a million things. What actually are the most important things that I should be doing? And it's almost like a refocus. It was like the great pause, as people have called it. But I mean, to your point, you're right. And I mean, now you're finding those things that really make sense. And some things you're probably going to eliminate. And maybe you're not going to have to travel as much just because you found different ways to connect with people and different ways to do this kind of stuff, right?
Very true. There were so many things on my list of things to do, and they were falling further and further down the list. And many of those were the things that were more important.
Yeah.
But you couldn't get to them because of running around. And I finally, what I've done now, what I wanted to do for a long time, is do more content through the podcast or the YouTube channel, educational content, things like that. And now we're doing that. And there's a natural byproduct to that. If you do that, everything is not about selling something and making money. That's part of what we do to make a living. But part of it is educating, giving people information about history, and sharing what you know. And by doing that, It enriches those people. And the side benefit of that is they know who you are if they're looking for something to visit you.
Yeah.
You know? So it's all good for everybody. And the pace is better now than it was before. Business-wise, obviously, all of us still need to recover from this because it's been a huge blow to everybody. Mm-hmm. Our online, you asked once earlier in the conversation about business, online business, Illinois, we do 95% of our business online. So Illinois has been actually, you know, good.
Yeah.
New York, mostly walk-in business. That's a problem. And it's going to take time to recover from that. Nashville, largely walk-in, but a decent amount online. So, you know, there's a balancing act to it. But things are starting to come back. We got back open in Nashville on May 11th. And we've seen each progressive month, you know, May was much, much better than April. And June is already halfway through June. We've done better than we did in all of April. So, you know, in all of May. So we're starting to see things come back. But it's going to be gradual. We don't, it's not going to happen overnight.
No, yeah, yeah. Let's talk a little bit about some of these drums. Now, you've got the Steve Maxwell custom drums, right? You still have those happening, and some of the Claviato probably too, right?
Yeah, the stuff that was under our own name, I don't really do much of that anymore. It was good. We did it for a while, but you know, the priority now is really just focused on. Well, since Johnny Claviato died, I was part of that business before he died, but since he died. Myself and one other person, we run that business entirely. So that's a big focus on anything from the manufacturing side. We're really focused on just the Claviato piece. And then within the shops, you know, we've still got the same formula we had before, which is obviously the vintage is a big part of what we do. And then a smaller number of major brands and fairly deep within those brands. So Gretsch, for all their U.S.-made drums, we're the largest dealer worldwide for them. We do a good amount of Ludwig with their USA-made products. And we try to not spread ourselves too thin. We don't carry 8 million varieties, and we don't carry everything from the lowest end of imports on up to the highest end. A lot of that is just, you know, race to the bottom for the cheapest price and who's got it online for 50 cents less. And that's not our market. So we kind of steer clear of that and go with what we know.
Why do you think in the year 2020 – people are still fascinated and still seek out some of these vintage drum sets to play? I mean, you would think that, I'm feeding this to you because there's a lot of people that'll watch this that don't have any idea why anybody would go buy a set from 1955 or something as opposed to buying something from 2020, right? So what is it about those drums? How are they made? How are they sound? I mean, why is it so different?
You know, it's a couple different things, and you have to start by saying there's a huge amount of wonderfully made product now. Every major manufacturer makes great instruments, so none of this is a knock on anything produced today. But what exists is there's only so many different ways to make a drum. So every new product that comes out isn't really all that much different. You got a lot of things that are kind of on the same wavelength with small differences here and there. But if you got a vintage kit, you've got something from the 50s, you've got something that's 70 years old. That wood has aged.
Yeah.
It was older wood to begin with, and then that wood has aged for 50, 60, 70 years. There's a character to that set that you can't get from something that's brand new. Right. So it's a combination of many different things, and those sounds are very unique. Even if you just think of Gretsch, when Gretsch had a maple poplar maple three ply with a rounded, you know, edge that the old reverse round over edges. And then later went to the six ply with the 30 degree edges, the maple gumwood shot. There's a sound to that. And then an aging to that wood, and people still seek those drums out today. And there are alternatives in the studio. So maybe someone's got a Killen DW or Pearl or Tama or Yamaha kit that they use, but for certain things, I want something different. Mm-hmm. You know, I want something that's got a little bit of a mellower tone to it or a different vibe to it. And that's where that stuff comes in.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I you know, I've been to the shop a bunch. I have some vintage drums. I mean, you know, you hear the difference. So the people that are listening to this that are not drummers, you would hear the difference. Let's talk briefly before we wrap this up. And again, I thank both of you guys, Steve Maxwell and Steve Maxwell Jr. of Steve Maxwell Vintage and Custom Drums. Of course, I've got all the links below, but it's maxwelldrums.com. They're doing a lot of great things on their website. They've got different podcasts coming up and all that. So let me ask Steve Jr., who's on the next podcast? What should people check out? And what should they be, what's like What's one of your favorite interviews that you did? And you can't say your father, okay?
Sure. Well, the one I just put up is pretty cool. He's an old friend of mine, Charles Rumbach. And have you heard of him?
Yeah, sure, of course.
He's a local Chicago guy.
Yep.
And he's just the sweetest guy. I had a great time talking to him, and there he talked a lot about.
And you did the one with Malik when
That one was a little while ago. That one was fantastic as well. We've had a lot of good ones. Yeah,
Before Wallace Roney passed.
Oh so
yeah,
they were in town playing at the showcase, and Malik came out and did this with Steven. And by the time we put it into production, Wallace had passed. So so that was a very timely. It just has a certain special nature to it because of what transpired.
That's Malik Coley. He's a really really just swell guy. He's from he's actually from like Africa, and he knows. He was living in New York. And he played in the band, and it was a really cool band because they had a lot of really mature guys, like college age guys, playing with Wallace.
Yeah.
I guess he always did that. It was the only one we've done so far where Malik actually requested. He said, "Hey, can you record us playing before?" So I set up the studio and we recorded the whole band, and then it starts. I can give you the link to it. It's Wallace isn't there, but everyone except for him. And then, we just talked about music, and it was great fun. But we have all kinds of good ones. That is definitely though one of the best for sure.
Well, and I know there's a lot of artists, a lot of world famous jazz musicians, but also some other instrumentalists that have bought drums from you guys over the years. And I know from being at the store in New York, I mean, you walk in there, you never know who's going to be sitting in there because, when everything is normal, everybody's playing gigs, moving in and out and running around, and they're popping in there to either just hang out or pick something up or borrow something, or something broke down the street and they got to pick up a cymbal stand and bring it back later or something. I mean, you guys are like that hub in New York. But you know so many people, and because of this vintage connection, I mean, you're able to talk to like some of these incredibly well-known musicians, all different genres, because they love vintage drums. They love the custom and vintage drum thing. Yeah. And that whole connection. Now I've got to ask you this before I let you off, Steve. You got to tell a story about what's like one of your favorite finds. Like, when you found a drum set, it was a vintage set, like, oh my God, I cannot believe this set. I can't believe this is here and I'm getting it right now. What's a good story?
I'll give you the short version because you can see it on my YouTube channel because I know we're pressed for time. But I was able to buy the Rogers kit that belonged to Louis Belson in the late 60s. It's white marine pearl with gold hardware. He loaned it to Sammy Davis Jr. Sammy never gave it back to him. Sammy went bankrupt. The IRS seized his assets. There was an auction. Someone in California bought the drum set, an actor. He called me many, many years later, told me the drum set. I was happy to buy it. I'm sitting in the bar in New York. A couple of years later, I get an email from a person who says to me, "I think we have some things that belong to your drum set." They had the trap case that had every single piece of hardware and Louis Belson's cymbals that got separated from that kit at the auction. So my friend, the actor, got the kit, sold it to me. I didn't know what happened to the hardware. I get an email out of the blue, and there is every single piece of 24-karat gold-plated hardware and Louis cymbals. And she said, "My husband cleans out houses that are being sold, and this house was being sold, and he just took this stuff, and we searched on the internet, and we found it." And I said, "I'll take it." And I actually literally had a friend of mine who runs a business called Sound Moves that moves instruments for all over the world. "Wade, get your guys out there, pick this stuff up, and drive it from California to New York City tomorrow." And we kept it with that kit, and that kit is on display in its entirety at the museum in Florida. David Frangione.
Oh my God!
That was the story from the Twilight Zone. That would never happen, right?
No, I would never. Are you kidding me? That's amazing. That's amazing.
That's the best story.
Well, and talk a little bit, just briefly, like what sets are on display at the museum that people can check out if they're able to visit it.
what I've got here in Illinois, I've got a Cadillac Green 13-16-22 matching snare with gold hardware, which was the same configuration as in Birdland. I've got Art Blakey's Pearl kit from the 80s that's a gold wrap 12-14-18 with the snare drum that went with it. That's mine. That's not going anywhere. We've also got an amazing Rogers kit that's not owned by anyone famous, but it's a one owner, literally next to the house, champagne sparkle, two 12s, two 18-inch bass drums, 14-inch floor tom, matching wood Dynasonic snare drum, all the stands and pedals, and it's like new old stock.
Wow.
So that's a couple of examples. I've got Jack DeJohnette's sonar kit, black with the copper hardware that's got a discography that's about three pages long on it. That's a beautiful set. Man. Those are some examples.
And those are all at the Illinois
don't
show.
Don't forget the purple diamond pearl.
Oh, God, yeah. Rogers, we've got a killing example in literally pristine condition of Rogers' purple diamond pearl, which was so rare, it's rarely ever seen. Crazy stuff.
And then Harold Jones, too.
I do. I have Harold Jones's Ludwig kit that he played in the White House. That's a good example, Stephen.
Oh, wow.
Harold played with the Paul Winter Sextet in the first integrated concert in the White House ever, in November of 62 for Jackie Kennedy.
Wow. And so, you've got that set. Yeah. Holy
that
cow.
That kit's on display. And when it leaves here, it's going to go to the American Black History Museum, donated in Harold's honor. Harold's still alive and playing with Tony Bennett when Tony's gigging, but this is going in Harold's honor to that museum.
Wow, that's amazing. So they can get all the information, maxwelldrums.com. Of course, if you're in Illinois watching this, you can pop out and see Stephen Jr. out there. He's there, and he'll show you all around. Sometimes Steve's there. Sometimes he's in New York during normal times. And, of course, all the information on all the shops, maxwelldrums.com. Guys, it was great catching up with you, man. I really appreciate you taking some time. I'm glad everybody's safe. Everybody's healthy. And we're getting through this whole situation. And looking forward to seeing you guys all in person at some point soon.
That was good, man. Thank you, Mike.
Right on.
All right. Thanks, guys. We'll talk soon.
Take care.
Bye.
Those guys are guys that know about vintage drums, as you can tell. And I've known them for quite a long time. So it was a pleasure having them jump on today. I'm glad we could hook that up because, you know, we didn't go down all the wormholes because the three of us could have talked for probably like two more hours about really getting into the different drum sets. But I will tell you, Steve made a great point about the fact about vintage drums and the age of the wood and the way they were built, and they were made in the U.S. and they're handmade. Nowadays, there's a lot of mass production of drum sets here and there. So when you buy a vintage set, when you have something that's, you know, even 25, 30, 35 years old, I've got a Yamaha Maple Custom from 92. So, I mean, you know, it's getting up there and the sound of that is incredible. So, you know, when you get into these old sets, you know, from the Gretsch back in the 50s, I mean, you know, the sound of these drums, it's really incredible. There's a lot of jazz guys in Chicago and throughout the world that use these drums, play them. So you can see them live a lot of times without rattling off names. There's a lot of musicians in Chicago that have a lot of vintage sets. So when you're able to go see live music again and see them performing, you will hopefully hear a little bit of a difference now that you heard a little explanation. I encourage everyone to go over to maxwelldrums.com, check everything out. If you're out in Glendale Heights, stop by. They're there. You can check out all these vintage sets, and they've got, as they were talking about, I mean, Louis Belson's set is sitting there, to Steve's point, what Steve's story was. Unbelievable. So, all right. So, anyways, thanks for watching. I appreciate everyone tuning in today. Hopefully everybody stayed safe over the weekend. Looks like we're going to have a great week ahead of us. We are announcing all of the guests coming up very shortly. So stay tuned. We've got a full slate this week. Just announced, by the way, our Blues and Beyond with Dave Katzman on Friday. We're going to have Joanna Connor is going to be on as our special guest. So that's going to be exciting. That's on Friday at 6 p.m. But of course, we have guests throughout the entire week. Actually, we're having a Thaddeus Tukes, the great vibist from Chicago. We're going to be having a preview listening party of his new release on Thursday at 6 p.m. So Thaddeus and I are going to be talking. We're going to be previewing a couple of tracks from his new release. That'll be a lot of fun, plus a whole lot more. So stick around. As I always say, if you like what you hear, like what you see, tell your neighbors, call the family, tell your grandkids. Chicago Music Revealed right here. I will see you back here at 6 p.m. tomorrow night. Stay safe.